This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Because it was just a year ago today that Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince was released. Let's bring it back, memories! This is MuggleCast episode 48 for July 16th, 2006. Your number one source for all your internet needs, GoDaddy.com has new domain names, transfers, and renewals for as low as $1.99. Plus, check out their hosting plans, website builders, secure certificates, and much more. Plus, as a MuggleCast listener, enter code MUGGLE, that's M-U-G-G-L-E, when you check out, and save an additional 10% off any order. Get your piece of the internet today at GoDaddy.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Kevin Steck.
I'm Jamie Lawrence.
And I'm Eric Skull.
And this is the show where we bring you the latest in Harry Potter news, theories, discussions, blah, 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 blah. And now we've learned that we total cars.
Yep.
What? Any reaction? Before we go anywhere else, my katana bombs standing by in the MuggleCast News Center with the past week's top Harry Potter news stories.
In a list of the 100 greatest family films compiled by Channel 4, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone came in at number 15. E.T. Shrek and Mary Poppins took the top three spots. At the 2006 Home Entertainment Awards, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire picked up prizes in the categories of DVD Extras of the Year and Sell-Through Title of the Year. The awards recognize outstanding achievement in home video. A new article published by Entertainment Weekly gives their take on the top sidekicks ever to be together, from real life to fantasy. Ron Weasley and Hermione Granger come in together at number 11, behind the likes of Ed McMahon, Robin, and George Costanza. Electronic Arts, the worldwide video game developer known to us for their work on the Harry Potter video game franchise, announced yesterday that they are actively developing 6 new titles to be released this fall for the Nintendo Wii. Of those, one is a new Harry Potter game specifically designed for the new video game system. The Wii's primary new feature is its controller, which is held with one hand and waved at the screen. From this, it's easy to assume that developers could create an area of the game that lets you cast spells with the flick of your wrist. Dan Radcliffe has released his most recent newsletter. Be sure to head over to danradcliffe.com to check it out. Last week, M. Night Shyamalan told ComingSoon.net that he has put some serious thought into directing either of the final two Potter films. On this Sunday's edition of PotterCast, Melissa Anelli talks with Shyamalan about the Boy Wizard. In a preview on Leaky Site, the director states he would offer the greatest protection on author J.K. Rowling's work. Finally, an article published today in Jam Television reports that Robbie Coltrane has just wrapped up his scenes on the 5th Harry Potter movie. All filming for Order of the Phoenix is scheduled to be completed by late fall. We are officially less than 1 year away from the release of the 5th film. The movie is slated to be released in the United States and the United Kingdom on July 13th, 2007. That's all the news for this July 15th, 2006 edition of MuggleCast. Back to the show.
All right, thank you, Micah. Wow, we have a few announcements to get through this week. Oh, how could I be so silly? I almost forgot the latest batch of names for my Katana Bomb. This one comes from Ryan, 18 of Virginia, who calls himself the Nickname King. I really like this.
I thought he meant that his nickname was King.
Ryan, the Nickname King.
Not that he calls himself the Nickname
King. Anyway, got it, yeah. Okay, what do you guys think of these? Micah Scope? Tannin in the Sun, and the Bombardier. Didn't we already think of that one?
I don't know.
I think we did. But interestingly enough, today, yes, last night, I went to the P.O. box, okay? And I open up the box, and I pull out this letter, and I start feeling it. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like 10 Subway gift cards. And I open it up, and it says on it, there's like a piece of what looks like bathroom tile. And it says, for Micah.
What?
And below it says,
does he,
for
like, collect
Micah.
Bathroom tiles or something?
No, for Micah. It's like the top of the table.
Oh, right.
That's for Micah.
That's clever.
It was great.
I just thought I found it.
So you're going to mail that to him?
Of course.
It's kind of heavy, though, isn't it?
No.
To mail.
He'll never see it.
Yeah, he won't ever see it.
It's a floor tile? Ben will put it in his room.
No, it's like it's a tabletop, but it looks like that. It's like a little sample.
here's a new name for him. When Micah starred in The Flintstones as Barney's baby, what was he called?
I don't know.
Have you guys seen The Flintstones?
Yeah.
I saw The Flintstones. What's
Barney's baby called?
94.
Barney's baby. Oh, Bam Bam.
Yeah, so change it a bit for Micah. Bomb Bomb.
Bomb Bomb. Bomb Bomb.
Shake your bomb bomb. Shake your bomb bomb.
All right, that's joke one of Jamie's joke of the day.
Yeah.
We got quite a few announcements this week. Don't forget to vote for us on Podcast Alley, because if you don't, we will cry ourselves to sleep, and there will be no MuggleCast.
Who are we in the lead on Podcast Alley?
No. Pottercast is still beating us.
Really? Even after last week?
Yeah. By like 20 votes, not by much.
Oh, guys, don't forget.
It's a pretty
that's
tight
because,
competition.
That's because their fans have more to do than homework when they're home. Don't forget that.
Well, see, they're offering their listeners an incentive for voting for them.
Which is what?
John's going to sing a song in New York for Joe. New York, New York.
Well, fine, then. Well,
we gotta offer them something, Jamie. Jamie, what do you want to do?
I wanna. Okay, if they vote for us and we win, then Ben will. I don't know.
I'll sing "Photograph" for everybody.
Yeah. No. You can sing
this
Ben.
Photograph.
Ben, you can sing what? "You're Beautiful" by James Blunt.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
You smiled at me on a subway.
On a subway.
You were with another man.
What did
you right. smiled at me in the subway?
Better.
What did James Blunt say to the? Hey Ben, what did James Blunt say to the 12-inch cheesesteak when the cheesesteak grinned at him?
You smiled at me in the subway. Actually, here's what I'm thinking. Okay, if I get. Oh, crap, I'm leaving Monday, so I wouldn't be able to know. Let's see. Okay, if we beat them by more than 100 votes, I'll do it.
Do what? Okay. Sing You're Beautiful. Right. Okay.
All right. It's on.
No, I don't know. I don't want
to
sing it.
But where is he
doing,
going
I can't
to sing
do it?
It.
Oh. I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm too big of a
All one. Right. I'll Jamie, you want to offer something?
Jamie will do
no,
it.
No, I won't. I'm already eating the sausages if... Harry dies. I can't take, you know.
Oh, yeah. Jamie, your sausages are very, very popular.
Yeah. Well, what can I say?
All right, Eric.
Jumbo
what
ones.
Will you do? If
what will I do?
He'll provide 500 photos for the fans. Oh no, wait, he's already done that.
No. No.
He'll make another
okay,
photo.
Okay. If we get what if we be if we be Pottercast, I will sing in person a
Elton John song. He'll sing Rocket Man.
No. Well, yeah, no, I do that. I'll do that for free. I'll do that for free. But anyway, there's a Britney Spears song, "Lucky." You know, "Lucky" by Britney Spears. And
no, I don't.
No, we don't.
A few of the people. A few of the people who run EvanLynchFans.net or one of the Evanna Lynch sites have a filk or you know, I guess a parody of it that they wanted me to sing for them. I told them I would. I'd record it called "Loony" for Luna Lovegood. And it's based on Britney Spears' "Lucky," and I will sing that in person if we beat Pottercast on Podcast Alley.
All right, wonderful. And an update on Lumos and New York City. Don't forget people to RSVP. We have over you. If you emailed an RSVP back before the new leaky mug site to hplive@gmail.com, we ask you to RSVP again on the leaky mug or not the leaky mug, just leakymug.com. Because it's much easier to count the RSVPs up that way. We have over 200 RSVPs for Lumos and over 600 RSVPs for New York.
Hey, Andrew, and your test this week is, can you remember what RSVP stands for?
Responde, s'il vous plaît.
Yeah, that's what I would
say. Responde, s'il vous plaît. Very close, very close.
We actually have a story about that, Jamie. For our chicken soup this
oh,
week.
Oh, yeah, we do.
If you've read it. Okay, Eric, and you have an announcement about Lumos in New York? Or Lumos?
Okay, so after the performance of Harry and the Potters, I wanted to get together maybe in the lobby of the J.W. Marriott or someplace. I don't know. I'm not very sure about the legality of any of this, but I wanted to get together and popcorn read one of the books of the Harry Potter series. Do you guys know what popcorn reading is? It's when you,
yeah,
when you read, like...
Yeah, I was four.
You read a little bit. Well, we'll all have name tags, and we're going
to...
What is it?
What do you have to do?
Popcorn reading. Okay, you take a book, and you start reading it. I guess you do voices and anything like that, and then when you get tired of reading, you say popcorn. popcorn, you stop reading and you say popcorn, and then you pick someone else, and then they start reading. And the deal is, we'll have a bunch of fans who don't know each other. The key is that you don't know each other. A bunch of fans get together and they'll read, I guess it's Prisoner of Azkaban I wanted to read, and we'll just read a little bit of it, be for like an hour or two after 10 o'clock or 8 o'clock, when the Harry and the Potters is done, and we'll just hear fellow fans doing the voices of all our beloved characters and just reading the book, and it's, you know, some kind of cool, cozy reading corner with Eric and you. Super awesome Vegas magical outing that night with Eric and you. Okay, and anybody who might be interested in coming to this, please email me at gasmoney@staff.mugglenet.com. You will either receive an update or I'll know how many people are interested, and then I will see by next week or at Lumos if I can actually do that, if we're allowed to congregate in a big lobby or something. So, once again, this is the super awesome Vegas magical outing at night with Eric and you. Save Gas Money is the acronym. And call, email gasmoney@staff.mugglenet.com.
As most of you know, every single week, a new transcript goes up of the past week's show. And as everyone knows, Micah Tannenbaum, or
bombs a lot,
Microscope heads that, or that, heads that section. And he has quite a few transcribers who we'd like to take a moment to thank. So, to Sarah, Allie, Martina, Jessica, Amanda, Ronnie, Rhiannon, David, and Margaret, and Emily, thank you very much for helping out with the transcripts. And we'll be seeing a few of them up in New York. And we'll be giving them MuggleCast t-shirts.
And hugs.
Listener rebuttals this week. Kylie32 of LA writes about the Mirror of Erised discussion we had last week. I absolutely loved your last discussion about the Mirror of Erised and whether Harry could use it for guidance to find Horcruxes. I just wanted to remind you guys that Dumbledore told Harry in Book 1 that the Mirror offers no knowledge nor truth. In my opinion, even though Harry saw his quote-unquote family, most of those characters that he saw were not real people, but people he had a deep and desperate desire to share life with. This is because we know that James was an only child, and Lily's only living relative was Petunia. Therefore, all the people he saw in the mirror were most likely people who could possibly be relatives, but were either dead or not real. That brings me to my next opinion, that there's absolutely no way he can use the mirror to find the Horcruxes, unless, of course, it was intended so with an enchantment, like the Philosopher's Stone. Because the mirror does not offer truth or knowledge, one cannot use it to seek either one.
I think that's a brilliant point. That's completely changed our discussion from last week.
Yeah, sorry,
we're stupid.
has it really?
Yeah, we said that it's a contradiction that the mirror can show your, you know, only your heart's desire, but it couldn't tell you something that, you know, it wasn't common knowledge, like the meaning of life. But what she's just said is that's completely wrong, because it shows neither knowledge or nor truth. So that's one to Kylie, zero to us. Thanks.
Our next listener rebuttal comes from Grace, age 17, from Minnesota. The subject, the Mirror of Erised. Hi guys, love the show. On episode 47, you were talking about the possibility of Harry seeing how to find a Horcrux within the Mirror of Erised. However, in her interview with Emerson and Melissa, Jo said Harry would have to see Voldemort finish dead, gone, wouldn't he? Because he knows now that he will have no peace and no rest until this is accomplished. This means that since finishing off Voldemort is his ultimate heart's desire, the mirror won't show him Horcruxes, since they are only a means to fulfilling that goal.
I think that's a really, really good point. I was thinking that last week when we were talking about it, but I don't think I mentioned it. I think that your heart's desire has got to be the final piece of the puzzle. You know, it can't be the means, because clearly you want the end more than you want the means. So, yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Harry's heart's desire changed. At first it was to see his family, and then at the end of it, it was to get the, you know, the Sorcerer's Stone and all that. And I really think that if Harry wanted it deep enough, he could see getting a Horcrux. If he had, like, one Horcrux left, and he...
But he doesn't want it.
He wants to find the Horcrux to kill it. He needs to do it.
But Eric, it's a shortcut to that he'd rather have at the end. So why would you... Okay, say if you wanted to cycle two states, yeah? You can either look in the mirror and see a brand new bike that's worth $50,000, or you can see yourself at the place. Which would you rather? You'd see yourself at the place, since you'd rather be there.
But you need the Horcrux. What I'm saying is, no, I'm not saying he could actually retrieve the Horcrux from the mirror. That doesn't, you know, because he obviously wants to use it, but...
No, but his true desire wouldn't ever be to see the Horcrux.
Jamie,
his true desire would be to finish Voldemort, yeah?
I think Eric's point is that maybe you're going to see that bike at first, right? Having the bike at first. But when you start working for the bike and you start earning that money and you're like, oh my God, this is killing me, you may see yourself going, yeah. Oh, geez, I really want to see myself at the bike place buying it.
No, what I'm saying is that Harry's desire changed. At first he wanted to see his family, then he wanted to get the, you know, it's an immediate thing. You can look in the mirror and see different things depending on your...
It's not immediate. Of course it's not immediate. It's built up. It's like pent up, you know...
What?
The deepest, most desperate desire in your heart doesn't just change it, you know, momentarily, just like Ben's band at the moment.
It does change. It does change. It changed for Harry in book one.
No. But yes, it does, but it doesn't just change suddenly. You know, events in the real world change it. It's like that.
Well, yeah, but events in the real world, like Harry, like... What I'm saying is I think that if he wanted to find a Horcrux, and if his heart's desire was to find a Horcrux, there's no reason why he shouldn't see that, just because it's a mean to defeating Voldemort. Sure, he wants to defeat...
What would he rather find, though?
He would rather defeat Voldemort, but...
How can his deepest, most desperate desire in his heart be any less than that goal now? Especially after, you know, Dumbledore's died, Sirius has died, you know, it's a war. How could he ever want to have a lesser, deepest desire than that, you know? And anyway, as Grace points out, it can't show truth or knowledge, so it couldn't show him finding a Horcrux. It could show him holding it, but that would be pointless.
Well,
you know,
truth or knowledge, I think that was just the way Dumbledore chose to explain it. Truth or knowledge was to deter Harry from staring at it.
No, but it didn't, you know, it didn't actually show him truth or knowledge. It just showed him holding it. So if the most deepest, most desperate desire in your heart is to have the Philosopher's Stone, you'd see yourself holding it. You wouldn't see yourself finding it, and it was just so that the enchantment worked.
If Harry found all the Horcruxes except one, right? Ron and Hermione both died trying to find that last Horcrux, right? And all he needs is finding that last Horcrux to kill Voldemort. I think if he looked in the Mirror of Erised, he'd see himself holding that last Horcrux and not killing Voldemort.
No, that's
I disagree.
Because the purpose, the sole reason that he's in it anymore is his deepest desire isn't to find the Horcruxes. It's what he's going to do with the Horcruxes, which is defeat Voldemort.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Okay. If you're in a situation, for example, earlier I went to Subway, and say my greatest deepest desire was to eat Subway. Would I see myself eating the sandwich, or would I see myself driving there? You know.
Yeah. Exactly. You'd see yourself eating the sandwich. You wouldn't see yourself driving there.
But if you wanted to make it to Subway, you would see yourself making it to Subway.
Well, why would Harry's greatest desire be to fight Voldemort? It's to have Voldemort dead.
I have another listener rebuttal that I just found, because we've been getting a lot of feedback about this discussion because it...
Hold on.
It's been going back and forth so much.
This is Lisa 16 from San Diego. Her subject is also Mirror of Erised. Lisa says, I disagree with what you were saying in the latest MuggleCast about the Mirror of Erised, because the mirror doesn't give you what you want most. It shows you what you want most. So if someone's most heartfelt desire really was to know the meaning of life, it would show that person knowing that secret, not give them the answer. I agree with that. So if the person desired to know the meaning of life so that they could be at peace or teach others or make the world a better place, they would see themselves doing these things or being those things, but not the meaning of life itself. So I don't think the mirror would show Harry where the Horcruxes were, but would rather show him what he would do with them. I see.
This is exactly right. Exactly what we were just talking about and what Grace said, that, you know, it can't show you... It can't give you what you want apart from when Dumbledore, you know, made it so. It just shows you what you want. I think that's a brilliant point. I think that's really good.
I would agree with... I think this set it a little bit clearer for me, at least to understand where you guys were coming from, that it would show Harry destroying the Horcruxes as opposed to finding the Horcruxes. Though, I guess I would argue that if he really wanted to find them, and if that were his...
The point she's making is that you wouldn't see yourself destroying it, you know, in the cave, because... The mirror can't know that it's in the cave. You just see yourself, like, I don't know, against a white background, destroying it, because, you know, it can't show you whatever. And perhaps if you perceive the Horcrux to be, say, a cup, then you'd see it being a cup. You know, it's your subconscious that tells you what you think it would be, so it can't actually tell you anything you don't know. It's just a projection of what you think.
Our next listener rebuttal comes from Niav, age 14, from Illinois. The subject, Snape's protective instinct. In regards to episode 47, I'd like to comment on the Snape protecting the trio issue. I agree that it could be a teacher's instinct, but I personally think the Snape isn't pure evil. He must have some compassion in him. It's hard to tell what side Snape is on, but I don't think that, at this point in his life, he would kill or let die an innocent student or anyone else unless he really, really had to. It's just hard for me to picture Snape that cruel. He always seemed more humane than many of the other Death Eaters. Thanks.
He is. That's the thing. He's mean. He's not cruel. I think that's the distinction you've got to make. You know?
I do think so. But I mean, then again, this was what occurred in the movie. So we shouldn't, you know, be theorizing about this too much. Because it was
true.
Just Steve Kloves going, hey, this would be nice.
Yeah, it was an interpretation of the book.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
So moving along to our main discussion this week, The Room of Requirements, spawned by Jamie Lawrence. So Jamie, this is all you.
Yes, I built the room. I built the Room of Requirement.
No.
Well, I thought this would be an extremely interesting topic because it's one of those things where you can't see where its brain is kept, so we can't really examine it. We don't know who made it, where it came from. It's kind of a second Chamber of Secrets, except it doesn't have a basilisk.
Which
in
is
it,
good.
Except, but I'm sure if you, it is good, but I'm sure if you walk past and wish for one, one would appear, or would it? I don't know. That's the kind of thing we're going to be discussing. Does it have limitations? Could you ask for a room that makes yourself immortal forever? And do the effects of the room only last while you're inside? So these are the kind of things we're going to be discussing. Should we start with how does it work?
Well, okay, it works. The Room of Requirement is located on the seventh floor, I guess. One of the corridors is the seventh floor. And in order to, it has to be activated. What it is, it's a blank slab of wall on the seventh floor in one of the corridors. Isn't there two statues, like, of some guy teaching goblins how to tap dance?
I don't know. I don't think that's important, though, to be fair.
Okay. Well, I was just being encyclopedic. Okay. Anyway,
There's a slight scratch on the brick just outside the room.
Hey, third brick from the left. It's happened before. So listen.
Hey.
In order to activate the room, you have to walk past it. You have to walk back and forth three times, thinking and requesting the wall to appear, or requesting a room. Room of Requirement is a good term because it's a variable, the room that you need. You can walk past it and say, I need a room to hide this potions book, or I need a room to hide from Filch. I need a room that is equipped for teaching of Defense Against Dark Arts, that kind of thing.
I need a room to snog Jamie.
One of the fundamental sort of laws of physics and, you know, the world is that you can't create something out of nothing. Now, magic, you know, we've seen that the effects of conjuring stuff don't last indefinitely, you know, and I think it follows that the more powerful a wizard you are, or witch, of course, the more complex, you know, the things you can conjure and the longer time they take to go away. But it also follows that are those things that you conjure real? And so, does the stuff that appears in the room, is that real, or is it just there as long as you're inside the room? Because it's like, can you take stuff out of the room?
Here's what my theory is on it.
Apart from stuff you put in.
Okay, when you go in the Room of Requirement, and say, like, what I've always thought is, why couldn't you walk past the door, why couldn't Quirrell do that and want a Sorcerer's Stone, or 300 Sorcerer's Stone? The items that appear in the room have to come from somewhere. They have to come from somewhere. And so, if the item isn't readily available, you couldn't wish for 400 Sorcerer's Stones because, you know, that just wouldn't happen. But, you know, things like a whistle or...
You mean you think there's like a warehouse somewhere and they just pick the items from it and it has to be in the warehouse?
Well, it's magical. I think you could take it out of there. I mean, if it's minor items, there has to, of course, be some limitations on it. Otherwise, you could take... You wish for a room full of gold, but that's not going to work. So I don't know. It's a magical understanding, so it's beyond our comprehension. It's not going to make sense to us. So I don't know where this stuff comes from. But
why are we discussing it then?
There's no point then.
Fine. Right, everyone, we're closing the show. That's enough. We're finished. I mean, so obviously it's impossible to understand how it works until we get further information, because we just don't know if you can take stuff out, apart from stuff you put in, like the book, or, you know... But obviously it has to have a link with something, because, the two cabinets, clearly it's... I mean, the room has to be on Earth, you know, because you can go straight from that cabinet to the one in Borgin and Burks. It's not like a different universe, but I just don't... I don't know. What does everyone think? Email us.
It pulled that cabinet from somewhere. That cabinet did exist in Hogwarts before it was in the Room of Requirement, because Fred and George Weasley stuffed the Slytherin Montague into that cabinet, and that is the, I guess we'll call it the Vanishing Cabinet?
The
Vanishing Cabinet. So that Vanishing Cabinet did exist prior to its either being placed in the Room of Requirement or something like that. Like, it was at Hogwarts, and I think, do you know where they said they got it? Where Fred and George got it when they shoved Montague into it? Do you know where
I can't remember, no.
Because the thing is, it's in there, and that's the question. How did it get there, and how did it get into that room? And
have you ever thought that maybe the items that appear in the Room of Requirement had to be brought in there at some point?
Oh, yeah, but you can't have everything. You can't cater for absolutely everyone who could possibly walk past it and wish for something, you know, because you'd have to put billions and millions and millions of items in there. But I think that you can put stuff
has
in.
Has to be in stock.
I just don't know if you can take stuff out that's been in there. Yeah, it has to be in stock. You like, hey, I want a computer and it says out of stock. So you think, oh no, I'll have to come back later.
Well, I don't know that it works like that, though. I mean, it's just quite... Well, you asked the question, if you asked for a room that made you immortal, you know, like, would that happen? I don't know. I think, is that even possible? Like, a room that makes you... Because I think a room that makes you immortal in there, or makes you safe, would just be a giant padded room, you know?
It's open to interpretation.
Like, but I don't think there's actually a room with, a gas in it that if you breathe it, it makes you immortal, or, like, a room with a fountain that if you drink from it, you're immortal. You know, I don't think it would do that.
It comes down to if a genie appears, can you wish for a million wishes? Can you break the laws thing? You know, so, like, do the effects of the room only last while you're in there?
I think because otherwise, couldn't you walk by the Room of Requirement and say, I want Voldemort to be in there, tied up with his hands behind his back so I can kill him, or I want Dumbledore or my parents to be in there alive. You know, you can't do that. So
No, obviously you can't do that. But it's stuff you need, though, isn't it? It's
you have to legitimately need it.
The Room of Requirement. It's not the room of what you want.
That's true. You have to legitimately need it.
Okay, well, I want to make it clear that at least the stuff doesn't go away, like, forever. Like, because the thing is, Draco was using the Room of Requirement in Book 6 to mend the broken Vanishing Cabinet. Now, the thing is, though, it couldn't have gone away after he was in there once, because as soon as he left, it would go back to being broken, or it would go, you know, he would never get anywhere with it.
But what does a Room of Requirement look like when it isn't being used? You know, it's like a Boggart thing. No one knows what a Boggart looks like when... It isn't
well,
in the form.
The whole point of the Room of Requirement is that you, it can be anything. It's a variable, and I think can't more than one room be open at once, because Harry was always trying to get into the room while Draco was in it, but Professor Trelawney looking for a place, and these were the exact specifications. She was looking for a place just to stash her sherry bottles, and she found the room that Draco was in. But Harry tried, I need to see the room that Draco is in, I need to see the room, you know, with the...
He didn't need to, though.
He tried all these...
Oh, I suppose she didn't need to... Yeah, but I don't think it can be used more than once. You know, more than once at the same time, because it's like, when...
But you can get into the room... If it's open, you can get into it.
Well, perhaps Draco said, I want this room to be completely safe from Harry Potter. You know, I do not want him to be able to get in. And it would have to honor that, because he said it first.
What's interesting about the Room of Requirement is that Joe did a lot of good foreshadowing with it in Book 4 when Dumbledore is telling Carcroft or Madame Maxine how he walked into a room with chamber pots, and then he can't find it again, because he was up late one night looking for the bathroom, and he stumbled upon a room with chamber pots.
He must have known it.
And
he must have known
about
it.
And also, wouldn't he know where the bathroom is? Seriously.
He probably would. I mean, he's lived there like 4 million
office?
Years.
I mean, doesn't he have
an ensuite? An ensuite bathroom to his office.
Conjure up a toilet? Couldn't he just conjure up a toilet?
No, Eric, because it would disappear and then the would just fall over the floor. What will happen to the room of requirement now because it has been established as a weakness to Hogwarts? Is there any way to empty it out or put it out of order or stop people using it?
Empty out the warehouse.
I mean, it had to be created by someone. And I would assume
the
that
four
if
founders,
the,
probably.
Yeah, if the enchantment was put in place, I'm sure that it can be taken down.
Away, yeah.
But can it be now that Dumbledore is gone? Because Dumbledore, I mean, put it this way, Dumbledore knew all those languages that Harry didn't even hear about, and I'm sure he's not the only one, but the fact is, all these enchantments, you know, were put on it since, you know, ancient magic that you couldn't read about in books, things like Horcruxes and stuff.
Yeah, but you would think as being a school that they'd have some history of what was done, and if anyone would know, it would be the headmaster or headmistress, and I would believe that the person who would know would be the next person in line to take over the school.
But it's something like the Chamber of Secrets. They really didn't believe it even existed. Until book two. Like they actually. So wait. If anybody knew about the Room of Requirement, wouldn't they go up to it and say, "I need the Chamber of Secrets"? Or
you have to legitimately need it.
I don't think it can give you something. Yeah, but it couldn't give you something that's elsewhere.
No, you don't have to need it. You just walk by and request it. You walk by and request it, and then it opens. Like
I think the answer is right here in the title, the Room of Requirement. It's like what we're
Jamie was just saying earlier.
Yeah, you absolutely need it. I guess. I mean, then again, did Harry need Dumbledore's army? Was that required? Or room for Dumbledore's army?
It was just a good idea where he really wanted the companionship and they needed a place. Well, they kind of needed a place against, you know, free from tyranny, free from umbrage, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly, and I don't think it's that he need Dumbledore's army.
Yeah.
He needed a room
just,
to
just
practice.
Just because you require something.
So he already had the army. He just required a room to practice that was private.
Just because you require something doesn't mean you need it, though. If you require a bicycle to carry out a bicycle, you know, ride across two states, that's something you want to do. It's not necessarily something you need to do.
No, require and need are synonymous. Require and need are synonymous in this instance.
I think they are, yeah.
Well, you want a room, you know, you want a place to hide your sherry bottles, but truthfully, nobody goes up to Trelawney's office. She could just put them underneath one of her...
Well, honestly speaking, do you legitimately need anything?
That's what I always think, yeah.
No, exactly, you don't. Harry doesn't need to find the Horcruxes. He doesn't need to. The you know, if you don't believe in fate and stuff, he doesn't need to.
Yeah.
Voldemort could win, you know. But that leads on to asking whether Voldemort could use it to hide the Horcruxes. Could he say, "I need a room that no one can ever get into apart from me"?
Well, see, I think he's too arrogant. I think that Voldemort is too arrogant to think that someone could ever figure him out.
No, but could he? Could he? It's
theoretically, is it possible?
No, but could he? That's the point.
I don't know.
It isn't about whether he would. Could he do it? But then that... But then why didn't they hold the Philosopher's Stone in there? I think it's just too unreliable, you know, the Room of Requirement. It doesn't seem like a sort of established thing that people use regularly. You know, it's like...
It's kind of like the Mirror of Erised. I mean, you can't really define
exactly.
What its limitations are based off what's been said in the book.
People don't know as well.
Good point, mate.
Yeah, about Voldemort and, you know, hiding his Horcruxes in there. I don't think he personally would have had any time at Hogwarts to hide a Horcrux in the Room of Requirement.
No, but could you? Could he do it, though?
Oh, well, could you? I don't know why you necessarily couldn't, but...
The Room of Requirement was first discovered in Goblet of Fire. Is that Joe's clever way of explaining what it is? Dumbledore needed to go to the bathroom. He couldn't, for some reason, he...
No, but he didn't need to. He could wait another 2 minutes or
maybe
another five
he could.
Minutes, you know.
Maybe he absolutely
could. He could, Andrew.
How do you know how strong his bladder is? How do you know how strong Dumbledore's bladder is? He's an old guy.
Okay, Andrew. He can clearly wait one more second, which means he didn't need to go
but
at that
is
time.
One more second?
If he absolutely needed to go, he could have just, you know, weed all over the floor if he needed to.
Well, that's the point. There would be a consequence to that. Maybe if there was a consequence to what you require, I don't...
I think
Dumbledore is more than capable of conjuring up a urinal to just to pee it, okay? Or a pot or anything. After he mentioned the room, he knew Harry was listening at that moment, and he turned and winked at him. This whole thing was about Dumbledore telling Harry about the room. The fact is, the question is not whether or not Dumbledore actually needed to go to the bathroom, because I don't think he did. He could have conjured up. And why doesn't he have a bathroom in his office? He lives up in the top of the tower. Does every night...
He brings up a fair point. It is a fair point.
Why can't he just zap the urine out of his bladder?
Yeah.
Because it is pensive.
Okay, are you sure he winked at him?
Yes.
Okay, he was telling Madame Maxime about how he doesn't know the secrets of Hogwarts. And it was just maybe contextually it may seem like he was doing that, but you know, Dumbledore is a mysterious man. Harry found it on his own. It isn't like Harry went searching for a room that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
That Harry didn't reference that in his memory the time that Dumbledore winked at him. So
next point: will Harry use the Room of Requirement to aid him in his quest in Book 7? Why or why not? I open that to the floor.
The floor. I have no idea.
Well, you can narrow it down a bit. Obviously, he's not going to use it for the Horcruxes, because that's just way too easy. I mean...
Yeah.
Don't get into that discussion again.
No.
Because I'm pretty sure you can't require the Horcruxes.
Right.
No, exactly. Right.
Well, there's an alternative. You can just kill off Voldemort. And this is my point of saying
exactly.
That there was no alternative for Dumbledore when he had to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
Anyway, is Harry even coming back to Hogwarts? I want him to.
Yes, yes, that's a dumb question, of course.
He can still use it, though.
No,
he's like
not.
An...
Not for the whole time.
No, he isn't for the whole time.
Yeah, he's always welcome in Hogwarts.
Exactly.
I don't know, the Room of Requirement, it seems like it was used twice now, and that's okay. Like, that's good enough. Like, the good side used it, the bad side used it.
What it seems... Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's like asking, will Harry retrieve the potions book? Will he retrieve Snape's Half-Blood Prince's book? You know, that's like asking that, or will he be able to? Because the thing is, he wanted to come back and get it. He never really got the chance to, but he wanted to because he marked it. He put the cage with the dead animal in it or something on top of the book, and then he marked the book or something. So he actually knows where the potions book is hidden if he can ever get into that room again. So, you know, why is that significant? Why did he mark his place? You know, is that going to be neglected? Will he never...
What I've noticed, though, doing this discussion is it doesn't seem like we have enough information about it. I think it's a literary thing as well. It's a, I don't know how to pronounce this, a deus ex machina. You know, God from a machine. It means it's a plot device capable of sorting out everything. So it's like... a big red button that just kills Voldemort, finds the Horcrux, you know, stuff like that. And obviously, that can't exist, or the entire magical world would be different, the laws would be different, so, obviously, Harry can't use it just to solve everything, or the books would just be two lines long. Harry went to the Room of Requirement, pressed the big red button, and Voldemort died. Yeah.
And then what's the second sentence? The end?
Yeah. The end was 7 seconds.
No, Scar.
Yeah, it's just Scar.
The end,
yeah,
Scar.
It's just... he pressed the big red button, then on the way out on the wall he hit his scar. Third sentence, ouch.
His scar jumped off his forehead. Da 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 da. The end. Okay,
so we can compare it to the Marauder's Map, Tom Riddle's diary, the Mirror of Erised, things where you can't see where they keep their brains, and Mr. Weasley warned Harry that you should never ever trust something where you can't see where it keeps its brain. So, should we trust the Room of Requirement?
Yes, because it's Hogwarts, and that's like asking, should you trust... Well, see, there's so many things about Hogwarts. Doors that open up into walls, things like that. So, what kind of question is that?
Isn't
like, if you were to ask this about the potions book, that's a separate question, because... It's just a book with stuff written in it. It's not like a live object. But the Room of Requirement isn't exactly a live object as much as Riddle's diary was.
Well, exactly.
Either.
It's
you know, and where you know, can you see where
it's?
But can you trust Hogwarts?
It's a matter of sentience, though.
You know, the Room of Requirement isn't. But the Room of Requirement isn't exactly a separate entity. I mean, it is part of Hogwarts after all, and it's part of the personality of at least you know one of the four founders, assuming. That they built it. That's like... You know.
Don't you think it's a matter of sentience where if things are self-aware and can actually think for themselves, like the room of requirement is just like a big program, really, and it gives you what you want. Well, it could be a program, or it could think for itself, whereas Tom, you know, Riddle's diary is completely different and could respond to different things. It was much more alive than the room of requirement, I think.
I think it's interesting, too. I think it's got some kind of intelligence, because you could ask just for a place to practice spells, and it would give you loads and loads of shelves of the best books, you know, and comfortable pillows to practice, you know, and that kind of thing. There's some kind of, because it gave Harry and the DA a lot more than they originally asked for, you know, they just asked for a room to practice spells.
But it's a matter of interpretation, though. It could just be a, you know, program to interpret stuff in a certain way, just like the Matrix.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm thinking it's like, but, you know, I think it does just react on your command. If you ask for something, it will interpret it and give it, but I don't think it's, you know, a separate entity with it. I think it's just part of Hogwarts. It's part of what makes Hogwarts magical. It's just another interesting room, another interesting stairway that changes, you know, something
like
that.
And once again, after that 15-minute discussion, we are yet to find a conclusion.
Well, that's you really can't, because there's no real answer. The only person who has the answer is Joe.
There's not enough information on it to...
Well, what I love about recording these podcasts is that we have all this saved, and we can go back and listen to it, and we were right there, we were wrong there. This is all, you know, it's like an archive of theories and stuff, so we should place bets on all this stuff that we talk about, so...
Yeah.
We really should. We already have one sausage bet.
Yeah, we do, unfortunately.
Now we're going to move on to a different story that we've yet to experience here on the show. This comes from Jim17 of Massachusetts. About a month ago, I had downloaded MuggleCast onto my MP3 player and was listening to it on my drive to work, and Laura said something that made me laugh really hard. In fact, it distracted me enough to not realize the car ahead of me was stopped, so I hit it going 50 miles per hour and totaled my car. Luckily, I walked away with only minor cuts. Well, since it was my first car, and most teens crashed their first one, last week my mom and dad got me a newer, better car in place of the old one, so I would like to thank Laura for getting me a new car.
And in fact, we're running a new service. Just write in what car you want, and it'll be shipped out to you as soon as possible.
But you have to prove to us that you actually crashed your own car.
So wait, what have we learned from Jim17? We've learned that Laura is funny.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. That's either. True, not car crashing worthy, but at least. So we emailed Jim back to get more information, and his parents bought him a new Pontiac Firebird in place of his now totaled 99 Volkswagen. And he actually attached a picture of this totaled
broken car.
It's more than just
broken.
Just a little accident. So we'll post this on the website. Now we have a fun favorite segment for you this week. Your favorite end battle scene. This comes from Alyssa, 13 of Massachusetts. She writes simply, "Hi, I'm Alyssa, and I just love the show. Keep up the great work, and I had an idea for the favorite segment, favorite end battle scene." Again, I love the show. Great email. So let's go around the table here. Start off with Eric, since he's been away for a while.
Favorite
Eric,
end battle
what's your
scene.
Favorite end battle scene?
I don't know. I'm very...
Wow, silence.
I like Book 5, I think, in the Ministry of Magic, because all those rooms and things that were mentioned were, you know, we're going around in the Ministry of Magic, you know, the Department of Mysteries, for crying out loud. And I would actually like to see... I don't know what the odds are of seeing that room or that whole department ever again. I think we should, but everything, you know... They burst through the door into another room, and we didn't know what the room was for and didn't really find out, but it was just all these, I guess, mysteries is the way to do it. And, you know, that battle scene not only had all the DA fighting for their lives, what they'd learned all year, but also then, you know, all the Death Eaters came, and all of the Order came, and Dumbledore faced Voldemort at the end. You know, Dumbledore and Voldemort against each other, nothing is better. I think Book 5.
I'd have to.
Yeah, same with me.
What was interesting about Order of the Phoenix was beforehand, people were asking Joe, you know, about the book, and she said, "Well, we're going to go somewhere new." And it was so funny because we went to five or six new places. We went to Grimald Place. We went to St. Mungo's. Went to the Department of Mysteries. I just found that interesting.
Yeah, there were a lot of new scenery. I don't know. Do you guys think we'll be back at the Department of Mysteries again? Because Harry kind of is staying away from the Ministry. Like, if he goes in, they're going
to. It has to be, doesn't it? Because the room but with the locked door, you know, the one, the love room.
That's so weird, because Dumbledore told Harry what was in the room, or he told them, like, about the room, but nobody can, like, ever enter that room.
Yeah.
Or something, or, the door's locked. Like, what, that's so weird, a room that contains love, like, what?
Well, clearly, he probably will be entering it.
Yeah.
Just because Dumbledore, you know, said that nobody could ever enter it.
And she sort of focused on it so much that it made everyone go, ooh, what's in there?
That's, the series is going to end in the love room.
He'll open the door and some huge heart will come out and just...
Yeah, Care Bears.
And just, it's just like Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, what broke open and, like, the angels came out and the sight was too holy for anybody and they had to close their eyes or else they died.
Yeah.
After the flood, all the colors came out.
But, I would have to agree as well. I think it was one of the best scenes in the whole series, especially Dumbledore versus Voldemort.
Voldemort
was awesome.
Oh, jeez, yeah. I about freaked out. That was...
It was the kind of, you know, it's kind of like an action film, which you watch, you know, just for the action. Just, it's so cool. You can't not like that scene, you know. Voldemort versus Dumbledore
there were so
is just
many
brilliant.
Cool... I mean, all the cool rooms, the time room and, the, you know, the Death
Eater exactly.
whose head was turned into a baby and, you know, grown back. And the Statue of Magical Brethren.
Yeah, that's awesome.
For crying out loud. That's, like, the coolest thing ever. So, I don't know. You guys think they'll do that good in the movie? The end battle scene in because, I mean, I'd like to see... I mean, Michael Gambon, yeah, I guess he could face Ralph Fiennes, but I don't know. It's just...
Well, we heard from Lucius... Well, not Lucius. We heard from Jason Isaacs that... he'll actually be doing a lot of shots on a huge green or blue screen. And this is leading people to believe that this whole end battle scene is going to be, all shot on blue screen, and then they're gonna chroma everyone in, and it's just gonna be mayhem everywhere you look, and they wouldn't possibly be able to do this all in one take with all the actors there at one time. So.
Yeah, so blue screen.
I think that, with battle scenes, you know, I think we need to pay some homage to the Goblet of Fire, Voldemort dueling Harry. That one.
Well, yeah, I was going to bring that one up because, and to think that it's going to be, we're going to be seeing it again, hopefully in book 7.
It'll be completely different though. He'll
be
more prepared, and
Harry won't be Harry. Hopefully, won't be the helpless kid he was in
it's
the
different.
Graveyard. You know.
Yeah, it's just.
I think the whole reason why people liked Book 5's duel between Dumbledore and Voldemort was it was actually a wizard duel where it was you know, it was the
cool
two
factor.
Most powerful wizards alive fighting.
It was a proper wizard duel, but also I think the coolest thing about it was the history behind it. You know, Dumbledore is the only one he ever feared, and there he was calling him Tom.
He called him Tom as well, yeah.
He called him Tom, exactly, and I really worry about Michael Gambon. I'm not gonna, you know, go into the old arguments about him, but I really don't think Michael Gambon cares enough about the history of Dumbledore or understands. You know, every interview, Michael.
They'll tell him though before he does.
Every interview, Michael Gambon's like, I don't really know what the hell I'm saying. I just go out and say it. So,
yeah, that's such a problem. That's terrible for WBPR.
He'll never be on the show. Michael Gambon will never be doing a fan interview for us.
I know, but. But he's gonna have to say, you know, I knew you'd come, Tom, or, you know, once again you fail to understand that, you know, mortality is not the worst thing. And he says that right
but
to him. And
Eric, he's an actor, though. It's the whole...
I know.
He can do it, though. They'll tell him what to do, and he'll do it as an experienced actor.
It doesn't matter. It depends on the screenwriter. It has to depend on the screenwriter. If the screenwriter puts it in right, then that's all it... matters.
I just have to get over it. That's all I have to do. I just have to get over, because the history, you know, we have to have this sense of world, this sense of... I worried about this before Goblet of Fire came out. I worried that the movies wouldn't be tied together in the same world because of all the acting changes.
The reason that this film is going to be so great is because you, like Jamie, I think, said, you're going to have, like in the book, you have this huge mass duel at the end, but... it's among these actors who we've seen in Prisoner of Azkaban, the film, all do a fantastic job, and now they're going to be in Order of the Phoenix all together, and these British actors really shine through.
They really
fantastic.
Are, yeah.
And
they're
whether you think
experienced actors.
Working together, I mean, with the kids and the adults, yeah, it's good, but the actors the older actors with each other are great, and whether Michael Gambon is a good Dumbledore or not, he's still going to be able to make it work.
I agree completely.
I think as well.
I think also though that end scene is especially good because we see new kinds of magic, like him conjuring the shield and the water going up and surrounding him, and there just doesn't seem to be any spell for causing a pool of water to surround him and suffocate him. You know, for us, it just seems like stuff that only the, you know, experienced wizards can do. Or
and the Fountain of Magical Brethren.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool,
as
too.
As I mentioned, yeah. But that's cool, Jamie, too. I think you pointed out that we could see a certain change and a certain allusion to the next movie where there's going to be all sorts of magic that makes no sense and, you know, nonverbal spells are being taught and, you know, all this magic that really just defies what we've, you know, convention, what we've learned so far.
Yeah.
You know, the only actual spells we've learned have been in the Dueling Club scene and then Alohomora in the first book. I mean, you know, not a lot else besides Lumos and Lumos Maxima. Actual spells, we're going to learn a lot more.
Lumos Maxima is a movie thing,
yeah,
isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. But Lumos is in
Lumos Maxima!
Maxima! Woo-hoo!
I've been rereading Order of the Phoenix, and every time there's a Dumbledore line, I just sit here and I take a minute to think how Michael Gambon is going to pull it off. Because I really like Michael Gambon, and I'm looking forward to
type.
The trial.
I could definitely see Richard Harris. No, I think Richard Harris would do a lot better job pulling off the serious Dumbledore.
I personally think the complete opposite. I don't think Richard Harris, I thought, was for some people the only Dumbledore, and I completely respect that. But I don't think he had that persona for Dumbledore at all. I think Michael Gambon, especially in Prisoner of Azkaban, right at the beginning, he sort of, you know, you really, really trusted
him. Oh no, he was way.
Well, but Andrew, does Andrew see what I'm saying with, you know, just with the interviews that Gambon gives, and he's like, yeah, I really don't know what the hell I'm doing. It's just a stupid kid's
movie.
Well,
that's true.
You know, he's like, this is.
He doesn't know what's going on in the books, but he's a great actor, and I think.
But he doesn't care either. He's like, I just read the script.
It doesn't matter if he doesn't care. It doesn't matter if he doesn't care, or if he doesn't know the history, or if he doesn't know anything. He's just got to deliver one line, and he has to do it well, and he's an actor. That's why he's a famous actor who's been in so much stuff, because he can do that. You don't think that every single adult actor has read the Potter books so they can give it their all. They're actors. They're actors and actresses. That's the whole point.
But here's a man who is openly insulting a large majority of the Harry Potter fan base in every interview.
Michael Gambon is that kind of guy. He's the sort of don't care, happy-go-lucky, swearing on TV shows. That's how he is. But if he can pull off the role, you know, in the film, I don't care what his history is like if he hasn't read the books or anything.
But we're all in agreement that the two final battle scenes with Voldemort are two of the best. Now let's move on to this week in Potter. Oh, this is a nice one. July 16th, 2005, merely a year ago.
The release date of this show.
Huh?
The show will be released on July 16th.
Oh, cool. So, where were all of we? Where were all of us?
Wow. Well, sounds better.
Jamie, where the hell were
Huffle
you?
Prince. I was in Edinburgh with Emerson, Melissa, Emerson's mum, and Melissa's two friends, and, which day did it come out? The 16th? The 15th?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the 16th. Then I think I had just got to Edinburgh, and I was meeting Emerson at the airport, and we were going to the hotel. Yep, that's where I was. Then 2 days later, I was at the castle. Edinburgh Castle.
Eric, where were you?
I was in Ohio. It was in Hudson, Ohio, and, there was a town event there for Book 6. The whole town, kind of like what happened with Oak Park, the whole town was turning into Diagon Alley shops, things like that. And I guess I was just, I don't want to call myself the MC, but I hosted, I was announcer for the events that were going on. But I was calling, I guess you guys were at, Spellbound.
I was at Spellbound.
Ben, where were you?
Spellbound.
I was at Spellbound in, what was the name of that little town? So it was near Chicago. I forget the name of the town, but I was at this town near Chicago at the mall at this party for the Muggleland sponsored, hanging out with Damon. That was the best part. And
eating waffles.
Yeah. Then we went to Then we went to the Hilton, and we got our books there. And then I stayed up until 4 a.m. reading on the couch in the Hilton. And then I went to sleep.
You didn't finish, did you?
Huh?
You didn't finish it, did you?
No, I was reading really slowly because I was trying to savor the moment.
I was actually at Borders in a local town. Just hanging out, waiting for the book to be released. Yeah.
You were...
I actually, if you read my About Us, if you read my About Us profile, I didn't go anywhere. I was in Ocean City. I was sort of
You were calling me.
For MuggleNet. Oh, yeah, that's right. I was calling you 30 million times, wasn't I?
We were the only ones that were actually near computers.
Jamie, how long did it take you to read
I finished at 12:30 in the afternoon. So we got back about 1:15 in the morning, and then I stayed up and read it all the way through till 12:30.
I was sort of... I took my time, too. Like Ben was saying, I took about a little under 2 days to read
it
because...
Terrible.
First of all... No, because I didn't touch MuggleNet that entire time that I was reading it, and I spent both days just reading, taking breaks in between and stuff, because our mail and stuff, we've said
oh
this
my god,
before,
we were
our
getting,
mail and stuff, it was just flooded with spoilers, it wasn't worth
it. Was horrible.
It. So, that's why I felt sort of forced to read it quickly like that.
Yeah.
So I could continue on MuggleNet.
Well, what about Order of the Phoenix? How long did Order of the Phoenix take you guys to read?
Order of the Phoenix took me longer, I think. I forget, though.
Oh, Order of the Phoenix took me, what was it, 8 hours, 9 hours?
Jamie, didn't you tell the...
Yes, I did, Andrew, thank you very much. Yes, I did.
Wait, explain it. I'm
okay,
finished.
I did like an interview for the BBC, and I said...
How long do you think it'll take you?
Well, I'm not a very fast reader, and I know it's a very big book, so it'll be slower than my children.
Yes, and Jamie?
I'm planning about 4 hours.
Really?
And
when are you going to start, do you reckon?
I think probably about 2 minutes past midnight.
Really? Just then go straight through.
Yeah.
That was great. That was great.
Probably took me about... three times that, but I couldn't say on air that I was thinking about maybe reading a bit, then going to McDonald's, then coming back and having a sleep, having a coffee.
Because
then
they were all under
more,
the assumption, yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't sound right, does it? So I said, yeah, about 4 hours, you know. absolute maximum, though, four hours, you know.
Yeah.
Were you trying to impress the BBC or something?
Well, no, I just couldn't
remember
say that, you know.
That one person was completely talking over you the whole time.
She actually knew her stuff pretty well. She knew what she was talking
about.
Yeah, but
isn't it, that video's on MuggleNet, isn't it?
No,
it is.
So.
Yeah,
yes, it is. I put it up.
All right,
but they were all under the assumption that you didn't know anything about Harry Potter. It was great. Like she was completely talking over you, never giving you a chance to answer or anything. It
well,
was great.
But that was pretty funny though. I laughed so hard when you said 4 hours.
Now it is time for this week's voicemail segment. Kevin Steck, get him rolling.
Hi, MuggleCast. This is Jason from Chicago, Illinois. I have a question. When I was listening to MuggleCast 46, Laura mentioned that she doubted Hermione was going to be the one to get killed off. That kind of jolted my memory back to, oddly enough, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, when during the chess game, Ron sacrificed himself so that Harry and Hermione could move on, and then Hermione kind of did the same by giving Harry the potion that would allow him to move on as well. My question is, what are the odds that J.K. would do it again in the sense that she would sacrifice Ron and Hermione so that Harry could survive in this case? All right. Love the show. Keep it up. Okay, bye.
No, I like that, though, because Laura was saying she was saying the books are symmetrical. So, like, in the beginning, Ron and Hermione had to drop out so that Harry could move on. Perhaps in Book 7, they have to drop out only in a more, how can we put it?
Morbid sense.
Yeah.
Morbid sense. Final sense. Final sense.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
I think
Sixth
it would be
sense.
Cool, the foreshadowing from
yes.
Yeah,
Book
definitely.
1 to Book 7.
No,
that would be pretty cool.
I don't see why it's a question. I mean, isn't it... It's been said now that eventually it has to be just Harry against Voldemort. So they're going to have to fall back and let... And, you know, they're more than keen on just falling back and letting him take Voldemort. They want to help him out as much as they could, but they know they're not going to actually be in the very, very, very final battle between Harry. You know, the prophecy says it just has to be Harry and Voldemort, so they will drop back. They'll fall back, but that doesn't, you know.
It doesn't, though. It just says that one has to kill the other. They could... I mean, Hermione and Ron could hold him down while Harry kills
it's
him.
It's true.
Which means that Harry has to kill him.
True, tickle yeah. him.
Yeah, but I think he's trying to say that, do you think it's possible that Ron is going to die for Harry, just like he sacrificed...
Oh, yeah. Of course, yeah. It is definitely possible.
I know, but it's like the new hot topic right now. Who's gonna die?
Of course, it is definitely possible, yeah. It's, I mean, one of them, I think everyone accepts that one of them will probably die, but it's people, you know, I don't think anyone is going to reach complete agreement until the book actually comes yep. out as to who is going to die or not.
I don't know why there's all this favoritism. It's almost as if you want Ron and Hermione to die.
No, no, it's not. It's
just because the prophecy says it has to be Harry and Voldemort at the final battle doesn't mean that Hermione and Ron won't be perfectly fine just back at home or something, you know? They will fall back. They will not be in the absolute final battle. That doesn't mean they'll have to die.
I think the reason why people are thinking that is it seems fitting that she has killed off two father figures. She has never killed off one of his true friends, like one of his childhood friends.
I mean, she's killed people close to him, but there's a difference between being Dumbledore and being Ron. You know, it's a complete difference.
So you're saying just because there's this open void where she hasn't killed a friend yet, she needs to kill a friend?
No. Well, yes, to make... No, but in some ways, yes, because, you know, it's a war. They're all going in together.
What will that teach him?
It's not teach him. It's to make it realistic. It's a battle. It's a war. If three people go in against three people from their other side, three teenagers aren't all going to come home, you know, nice, and all completely alive, you know.
Hi, MuggleCast. This is Andrea calling from Vancouver, British Columbia, and I want to know what you think about something. On DumbledoreIsNotDead.com, one of the clues cited is that when Dumbledore is hit with Avada Kedavra, he is sent flying off the astronomy tower. The site contends that this could not have been a real killing curse, since in every other instance of Avada Kedavra we've seen, the victim simply slumps down onto the floor. However, I think there is evidence that the physical impact of any curse can be affected by the degree of emotion behind it. In Order of the Phoenix, page 336, UK edition, Harry is hit with the Impedimenta curse to stop him punching Malfoy, and he is knocked over backwards by the force of the spell. Later, when practicing Impedimenta at a DA meeting, the victims are simply frozen for a minute or so, page 401, UK edition. So if this were true, it would mean that if there is a lot of emotion behind Snape's AK, which I think is evidenced in the description of hatred and revulsion in his face, then it is possible that the curse could have sent Dumbledore flying off the tower. Just wanted to hear what you thought. Thanks.
I think what she's talking about is, like, do you remember in Order of the Phoenix right at the end when Harry tried to use the Cruciatus Curse on Bellatrix and he wasn't thinking the right emotion, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he was just angry and you used to actually want to cause him pain. I think that's right, because when Snape uses the Killing Curse on Dumbledore, it says that, you know, his face is screwed up in complete loathing. So I think it must, you know, the spell must be made more powerful by the kind of emotion behind you, because that's like a running theme throughout the entire books, so that magic isn't only dependent on your wand and the spell, you know, it's dependent on the personality, the force behind it. So I do think it's made more powerful, yeah.
But again, I don't think that any amount of force would have changed...
Oh, the outcome, no, of course not.
Well, no, or the fact that Dumbledore moved. I don't think don't think the fact that Dumbledore moved had anything to do with Snape being off upset with Dumbledore. You know, I think the whole reason he moved was completely separate. You know, the same kind of separate where
because he was powerful.
People go up to Harry, where people go up to Harry and say the only exception to the death curse, you know, sits in front of you. It was something so vastly different. I don't think it had anything to do with how, you know, upset.
The thing is, saying that, you can't have degrees of killing curse. You know, it either kills you or it doesn't. So perhaps that loathing, that anger has to show itself in a different way, so like the body flying backwards a long way or you know, something like that, because if the body just lands and, you know, its eyes are wide and it's being killed, you can't tell how powerful the curse was that killed it, if that makes sense.
Well, it's interesting too, because they attribute Harry's scar, or at least Dumbledore attributes the actual scar to the death curse.
He
doesn't attribute it to Voldemort exactly. He doesn't. Otherwise, there would be a lot more support for the Horcrux theory of the scar. But Dumbledore actually says that the scar is a mark of the death curse. So that's really weird. Because if it's, you know, the death curse doesn't usually leave a mark, he says, you know, the exception sits before me. Or something along those lines. where Dumbledore, you know, who was aware about Horcruxes at the time, actually says the Death Curse made the scar. So maybe, you know, the Death Curse may behave differently depending on the people casting, but I don't know what to make about it. It's like, we thought that, originally we speculated in the beginning couple of episodes that it was just the amount of power that Dumbledore had that it made an impact because of how powerful, you know, stuff like that.
Hi, MuggleCast. My name is Amanda and I'm from New Jersey. I have a theory about the ring Horcrux that Dumbledore was wearing in Half-Blood Prince. The ring contained the Peverell coat of arms, and after researching Peverell, I found that the coat of arms contained a lion. Do you think this could be the real Gryffindor Horcrux? If so, it leaves open the possibility of a new Slytherin Horcrux, which might be easier to locate in the book. I'd love to know what you think. Thanks. Love your show.
Mr. Gaunt is clearly very, very patriotic, you know, and sort of elitist. I doubt he would wear any ring that had any significance with, you know, Gryffindor or anything other than Slytherin, considering his background. Unless, of course, he didn't know, but I consider that unlikely.
Yeah. Agreed. I don't even remember that line. Yeah. I just read that last week, but I don't remember a lion being on the ring.
Oh, no, it's research that she did.
Yeah.
So like research.
Yeah, because Peverell relates to lions.
Oh, actually, well, that's kind of cool, but I do think Gaunt would have made sure, or would have at least been,
Yeah.
And Dumbledore would probably be able to tell. I don't know.
We're going
to
wrap things up this week with a chicken soup. J20 of Ohio writes, the other day at work during lunch, I was wearing my MuggleCast t-shirts. Hey, everyone buy one today. My friend Susie, he put it in quotes, so I guess he's trying to protect her identity, said, what's the point in listening to MuggleCast? I understand you like reading it, but come on. What do you learn from MuggleCast? So then yesterday, after listening to the newest episode at work, I learned something. Jamie taught me what RSVP means. So I went up to Susie and said, what does RSVP mean? And she didn't know what. And I said, well, today, Jamie from MuggleCast taught me what it means. It means, Jamie,
Répondez s'il vous plaît.
See, you can learn from MuggleCast.
Yes.
So thank you, Jamie, for helping me put that dizzy cow back in her place. You rock. Wow.
Woo. Every 47 episodes of MuggleCast, when we become an educational dispenser, we can prove Dizzy Cow's wrong.
Well, that does it for this week's show, but we have a few more little notes for everyone. Episode 50 is quickly approaching, and we want your favorite MuggleCast moments and favorite quotes from the show sent in via our phone numbers, 1218-20-MAGIC. And our two new phone numbers in the United Kingdom, you can call 020-8144-0677. And in Australia, 02-8003-5668. So please send in your favorite moments and anything else that you would like to say about MuggleCast. We're going to have like a big block of voicemails at the end of episode 50. We're all going to be recording episode 50 in Vegas together, so that will be very interesting.
Woo-hoo.
And
I'll be laying on the bed.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And next week, we are going to make our second attempt at MuggleCast Live. We have a new server. Huge thanks to Jeremy. He's been helping us out with this, and he's been really excited to get this going with us. So next week, MuggleCast Live, Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to have a lot of fun with it. 10? We're gonna have a lot of fun with it, and there's a limit of 300 people who can access this feed. It's not a Skype cast this time, thank God. For more information, visit the MuggleCast website. Yeah. So Ben, our PO box is
PO box 223, Moundridge, Kansas 67107.
Send us stuff and you get your name on the show. And send your listener rebuttals, question, comments, suggestions, complaints, whatever you want to mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. You can also find all our contact information on the MuggleCast website. Did I say mugglecast@staff.mugglecast.com? I meant at mugglenet.com. Before we go anywhere...
Okay, I haven't done my joke.
Jamie...
Okay, so, here's a nice short one. A man walks into a doctor's office. He has a cucumber up his nose, a carrot in his left ear, and a banana in his right ear. What's the matter with me? He asks the doctor. The doctor replies, you aren't eating properly.
Actually, I think
that was pretty good.
That's going to destroy your rep. Dude.
Hey, it's already downhill considerably. I don't think it can go any lower on the jokes.
Well, Jamie, I just want to thank you real quick for coming through with your promise of doing two jokes. I mean,
oh, well, thank you. Well, I mean, yeah. I thought these people deserve two brand new, previously unheard jokes because you know I didn't say any last week.
So
let's
hear it.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Well, there's this guy. He's like an international wasp expert. He knows absolutely everything about wasps. There's nothing on wasps he doesn't know. One day he's walking down the street. He walks past a CD store and he sees an advert that says the best tape of wasp sounds ever. Come in and listen. And he thinks, well, I'm the international wasp expert and I haven't ever heard this tape. So how do they know it's the best ever? I haven't certified it. So he walks in and he says to the person there, listen, do you know who I am? I'm the international wasp expert. Do you think I can listen to this this tape and I can tell you if it is the greatest tape of wasp sounds ever? So the man says, well, yeah. Okay then, so he takes him over to the player and plugs him in, gives him the headphones and presses play. The person listens and he thinks, well, I can't hear any wasp sounds at all. You know, what the hell is this? So he goes back to the store person and says, wait, excuse me, but I couldn't hear any wasp sounds at all, and you told me that this was the greatest wasp sound tape ever. So the person says, well, come on then, I'll go and try again. So he goes back, plugs him in, gives him the headphones, presses play, and once again, he can't hear anything at all, any wasp sounds. And he's getting extremely annoyed now because he's the international wasp expert, and, you know, he doesn't have that much time on his hands. So he goes back and says, now listen, you know, you really do have to tell me now. It's do you think you can please show me the wasp sound? So he says, well, yeah, well, come on then, we'll go and try again. And he goes back and he says, right, do you think you can stay here now so when it goes wrong, you can, you know, you can see what's happening? So he plugs him in, gives him the headphones, presses play, and he listens to it, and he says, once again, well, I can't hear any wasp sounds at all. So the store person stands there, and suddenly a look of dawning comprehension comes on his face, and he says, oh, that's why you can't hear any wasp sounds. You're listening to the B-side.
Oh, my God. That is excellent. On that note, I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Kevin Steck.
I'm Jamie Lawrence.
And I'm Eric Skull, reminding you to save gas money.
Ben Shane, you're in the studio here with me next week.
Yeah.
I cannot wait.
Monday morning, 5:43 a.m., meet me at Wichita Mid-Continent Airport, okay? Everybody be
Say
there.
Say goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Good night,
everybody.
Now it is time for this week's voicemail segment. Kevin Steck, get him rolling.
You roll him. I don't have him on.
Oh, man.
I sent them
come
to
on.
You.
Oh, jeez. Oh, I don't have. You're just too lazy to play him.
No,
that,
I actually
that
don't
concludes
have
our voicemails
I have
for the
on
week.
My external hard drive, which is connected to a different computer.
Oh, what? Kevin Steck is disconnected now?
No.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Really connected, Kevin. All right, here we go.